Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc webinar called Combating Anti-Semitism on College Campuses, a look at the Trump administration's civil rights enforcement efforts 1 year in. Today, we're fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Andrew Grossman, who is a partner at Baker Hostetler, LLP. He has appeared before the Supreme Court, nearly all the federal courts of appeals, as well as some state appellate courts, litigating high-profile and complex commercial, administrative, and constitutional issues. He advises members of Congress on matters of constitutional and administrative law, having testified more than a dozen times before the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. Mr. Grossman is also a senior legal fellow at the Buckeye Institute and an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute. I'll leave it to him to introduce our other guests. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Mr. Grossman, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this discussion. Let me offer a few introductory remarks, then we'll introduce the speakers and we'll get to their remarks. Over the past year and a half, U.S. universities have witnessed an unprecedented wave of violence, threats, and harassment against Jews. A recent article by Professor David Bernstein of the Scalia Law School documents a surge of anti-Semitic assaults, threats, vandalism, and intimidation on and around American campuses. And that's coincided with widespread rhetoric endorsing or glorifying violence against Israelis, supporters of Israelis, and Jews at campus protests and even in classroom instruction. The Trump administration's response has been forceful. In February of last year, the administration launched the Task Force to Combat Anti-Semitism, charging it to, quote, root out anti-Semitic harassment in schools and on college campuses. In March of last year, the administration announced a comprehensive review of universities' response to anti-Semitic harassment and their compliance with anti-discrimination requirements that are a condition of federal funding. It then proceeded to cancel $400 million in grants and contracts to Columbia University, citing Columbia's inaction in the face of persistent harassment of Jewish students. It threatened 60 more universities with loss of funding for anti-Semitic discrimination and harassment. And it put Harvard on notice that it was at risk of losing $9 billion in federal funding. The year since then has seen a spate of litigation, including an anti-discrimination lawsuit the administration filed against Harvard just last week. But there's been far more behind-the-scenes negotiation, deal-making, and jawboning. Columbia, for example, struck a settlement requiring it to enforce its time, place, and manner restrictions on protests, to enforce its disciplinary policies, to impose punishments for encampments in violation of those policies, and to review its regional studies programs that teach about the Middle East and Israel. Even without settlements with the administration, other universities have seemingly gotten the message and changed their approaches. Yale and Dartmouth, for example, both cleared pro-Palestinian encampments erected in violation of their rules. And a number of schools, including Yale and the University of Michigan, have de-recognized pro-Palestinian student groups for violating protest rules. Critics say the administration's enforcement efforts threaten free speech rights, including those of anti-Israel protesters, faculty who consider Israel an illegitimate or a malign state, and the universities themselves and their rights to determine their curricula and determine which events occur on campus. This is, of course, not the first time that anti-discrimination law has been seen to be in tension with free speech rights. And that tension is the focus of our panel today. So let me introduce very briefly our panelists. As Sarah said, if you'd like to learn more information about them, please visit the Federal Society's website. Kicking off our discussion will be Ilya Shapiro, who is a senior fellow and director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute. And he's the author, most recently, of the book Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites. After Ilya is Eric Jaffe, who's a partner at Share Jaffe, and has litigated many important First Amendment cases. He's also the co-founder of the recently launched group Neutral Principles. And finally, joining us perhaps a few minutes late, will be Professor David Cole. He is the Honorable George Mitchell Professor in Law and Public Policy at the Georgetown University Law Center, and he formerly served as the National Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. We hope that he will join us shortly. So with that, Ilya.
Great. Well, thanks very much. This is an important topic. When we originally scheduled it some months ago, there were other news for it. But now we have yet another news hook, as I think just this week or late last week, the Justice Department sued Harvard over anti-Semitic activity, or rather not doing enough, thereby violating Title VI to protect equal educational opportunities for its Jewish students. And that's just the latest in various investigations, lawsuits, settlements, and other actions aimed at civil rights generally in higher education and anti-Semitism specifically. The administration has been more successful when it jumps through all the statutory hoops, namely launching an investigation, issuing findings, making demands based on those findings, and then getting capitulation or agreement or remedy settlements of various kinds. It's run into legal roadblocks, more specifically procedural roadblocks in the courts when it tries to skip one of those steps. And just as it did, I think, in April of last year, issued demand letters without the formal investigative process to precede it. And so lower courts have called process fouls and said you can't you can't do that. That's not following the statute, whether that be Title VI or other relevant authority. But setting the process fouls aside, on the substance of the matter, I think our universities, and especially our so-called elite universities, have been failing both broadly on the civil rights front and more narrowly on the anti-Semitism front, in letting so much behavior by students, by outside activists, structurally within the university, having various conditions, programs, protests, disruptions, that hurts both Jewish students, Jewish applicants, and more broadly, when we broaden the lens to civil rights in general, not complying with Students for Fair Admission, other race-based, identity-based decision-making that violates Title VI and other civil rights statutes. Where this intercedes with free speech, I think, well, I look forward to hearing what Eric and David have to say, is with demands that departments be ideologically balanced, other viewpoint type things that don't have to do with decisions on admissions and employment based on protected categories. And there, I think there are some definitional issues, both in kind of demand letters and in the proposed compact with educational institutions, both because it's unclear exactly what ideological balance might mean or viewpoint balance. You know, there have to be multiple perspectives on quantum mechanics, or is it that we want half of the quantum mechanics professors or the physics professors to be Republican versus Democrat? Does that even matter in the area of physics? All of these sorts of issues of trying to maintain that. Now, I think the administration is on safer ground to try to dictate the Shills report, the third part of the Chicago trifecta. So the free speech guarantees, the Calvin report, which has gotten better known about institutional neutrality, and the third part, the Shills report, non-discrimination by viewpoint in hiring. I think given that there is a role for the government to play with strings attached to funding in enforcing free speech concerns and academic freedom concerns, even though people like the president of my alma mater, Chris Eisgruber, have tried to fly the flag of academic freedom and free speech, I think he's got it backwards in many ways, because these committees for hiring or admissions that do discriminate based on viewpoint, I think, are impinging on those very things that they claim to defend. But we can get into that. I think that's my overview of my perspective.
Thank you, Ilya. Eric?
Well, there are certainly points on which Ilya and I agree. I agree that many institutions of higher education, Harvard, Columbia, others, UCLA, behaved abysmally in the wake of October 7th, and did little or nothing to actually protect students from threats and harassment and all of that stuff. I think we disagree on the administration's response to it. Ilya phrases it as sort of awkward and imprecise, and I would phrase it slightly differently. I think much of the initial response was of the variety of let no good crisis go unwasted. If you look at the April 3rd demand letter to Harvard and the follow-up things, the demands had little to do with the anti-Semitic problems and more to do with a long-running despising of higher ed, particularly because it was viewed as lefty and woke. And so to mix those two is problematic for someone like me, where I care quite a bit about anti-Semitism and having equal access to things like the quad and the library and dorms and classes. But I am much more pluralistic in what universities do about their wokeness in other contexts, and think that federal programs should not be able to dictate the internal balance of viewpoints at universities, whether it's in hiring or whether it's in the academic viewpoints, even if it's on sensitive topics like Israel or race or gender and sex. I think that the neutrality needs to be at the programmatic level, at the federal level. And so, yes, I believe that schools with one viewpoint should be allowed in, and schools with the other viewpoint should have equal access to funds. And my easiest example for that is religious schools, which certainly do not purport to be viewpoint neutral, and I think would deeply object to any test to make them viewpoint neutral on any of these topics, whether it's political, whether it's religious, whether it's sexual, whether it's race. If from a conservative perspective, if you're thinking about this, one needs to ask, do the rights of free association and for sort of free thought, whether it's religious thought or sort of normal, speech-related First Amendment thought, whether those trump our desire to have each institution model the First Amendment? Because I don't actually think the First Amendment applies. So what I would say is, yes, we should be looking to things like Title VI. We should be insisting on enforcement of time, place, manner restrictions. I do not think this administration is actually doing that. I think that they just picked a couple of examples to beat up on people and then were happy to drop their enforcement and concerns the moment they promised to hire more conservatives. And that is the abuse of a statute like Title VI, not the sort of fair implementation of it. I actually have problems with Title VI, full stop. I have problems with strings on federal funding, full stop. I think those are all unconstitutional conditions and arguably should be given strict scrutiny under the First Amendment, but that's probably a much bigger topic. I don't agree with Ilya that the government has a lot of leeway in putting strings on, and I certainly don't agree that they can put strings on programs that don't have a nexus to the actual bad behavior. So if you're hiring crappy people in the Middle East department, I don't understand why that means you get to yank all the DARPA funds from the biology department. Those seem a bit too far afield and looks like big footing on free speech. So that's my general perspective on it. I'm sure we'll talk more about it as we get back into it. I want to give Professor Cole a chance to chime in as well. But I view this more as a free speech problem with the anti-Semitism being sort of a straw man that is very important and is being sort of misused and abused by folks who have a bigger agenda.
Can I just say one thing about the strings that are attached and how Eric described them? There actually is no germaneness or proportionality requirement attached to federal funds. So indeed, if it's a wacky professor in the Middle Eastern Studies Department or a DEI officer or anybody else at the university, if they misbehave and violate Title VI or other civil rights statutes in various ways, then yes, all the funding to the medical school could be jeopardized. Now, whether it's wise to do so is a separate question. Whether you should be in policy, you know, best policy practice would be, you know, minor violation means, you know, a smaller amount is in jeopardy. But when President Reagan was signing this, he didn't want that. And Congress overruled him and removed any sort of germaneness or proportionality requirement.
I don't take any position on what the statute says, though I've seen some arguments the other way. My position is strictly a constitutional question, that I think that level of leverage is unconstitutional. I don't care actually what the statute says. So,
great. Professor Cole?
Yeah, so first of all, my apologies for being late. I was teaching till noon, so it's hard to get out of there immediately. Thank you for having me, and thank you for having this this webinar. I think it's a hugely important topic and a topic about which all Americans of all stripes should be deeply concerned for many of the reasons that Eric has laid out. I do think this is largely a pretext that the administration is not doesn't really care about anti-Semitism. They see it as a tool with which to bludgeon entities that they oppose because they oppose their political views and they oppose their sort of ideological slant. I have long been an advocate for ideological diversity in university settings, as well as race and class diversity. I think ideological diversity is important. I think we need to do more. And I wrote a piece about this before Trump came into office and noted that a wide variety of institutions were in response to criticisms by conservatives of the kind of ideological valence at some of many elite universities and conservative students feeling they didn't feel the same freedom to express their views as their liberal counterparts had, that many universities were engaging in self-studies and setting up committees and adopting programs that were designed precisely to address that concern. Georgetown was one. I headed up a free speech and campus culture working group that was designed to, you know, address precisely that and recommended that we, you know, bring in more conservative voices, that we model disagreement across ideological divides, and that's, you know, essential to effective education. So I support the view that we should have ideological diversity. But the sad thing is that We were moving in that direction. And now Trump, by sort of taking a bludgeon and trying to impose it unconstitutionally through government coercion, may well cause a more resistance to that idea than there actually was. Because, you know, even though I am in support of ideological diversity, I am not in support of ideological diversity imposed by government. And I don't think anybody should, on any side of the spectrum, support giving the government the power to start controlling, who teaches and what they teach and from what viewpoints they teach. Academic freedom is too important a value to sort of sacrifice in the interest of some short-term goal. So that's my principal concern. I think this is an attack, really the biggest attack on academic freedom since the McCarthy era, and deeply disturbing. On the anti-Semitism side, first of all, I don't think the statute is as broad as Ilya suggests with respect to the ability to punish wholly unconnected institutions. There is a kind of requirement to try to tie the remedy to the violation. And the Trump administration has made zero effort. They've actually made an effort not to tie the penalty to the violation, but also they've made no effort to really assess what is a violation of Title VI versus what is a pro-Palestinian protest. Because not all pro-Palestinian protests are violations of Title VI. Not all slogans, from the river to the sea or global intifada are a violation of Title VI. Title VI does not preclude offensive speech, anti-Semitic speech, out on the mall, in the course of a protest involving a war in which, one side is identified with the Muslim faith and the other side is identified with the Jewish faith. It is about discrimination against people because of who they are. And saying something offensive to someone, conservatives should be the first to be saying, saying something that's offensive to someone, and Ilya should be the first to say, saying something that's offensive to somebody on race or sex grounds, as he did when Biden had a choice about who to put on the Supreme Court, is not a violation of Title VI, is not discrimination. But the Trump administration has made zero effort to draw that distinction. The congressional committee, which I testified before, on which Elise Stefanik was the most prominent figure, made no attempt to distinguish between pro-Palestinian protest and anti-Semitic discrimination. And there is a huge difference under the law. And all you need to do is read the OCR complaint against Harvard to see that. Literally every protest, they identified every pro-Palestinian protest as an incident of anti-Semitism without any evidence that any particular student was targeted, that any particular anti-Semitic statement was made. It was enough that students were protesting. And they were protesting against Israel to treat that as anti-Semitism. That's just a total misunderstanding and misappropriation of Title VI.
All right, I'll say that I agree with David on kind of the tactical point that by stealing certain steps, as I previously described it, levying the demand letter before the investigation was concluded, the administration did allow defenders of illiberalism on campus to kind of dig in and fly the flag of, now we're being coerced and oppressed by the government, which muddied the waters over all the bad stuff that's been going on campuses in recent years. And I don't think this is all that bad stuff, I don't mean, you know, the latest iteration of the decades of faculty left wing bias. That's gone on for a long time. Although the Berkeley free speech movement, the hippies who took over the faculty lounge would now be called retrograde white supremacists by today's radicals. But be that as it may, what's different now is the over bureaucratization and the failures of leadership that we've saw in real time after October 7th, how different campuses responded in different ways. And, you know, the leadership of Ben Sasse at Florida or Daniel Diermeier at Vanderbilt in ejecting people who had taken over lawns and blocked access, taken over buildings and so forth, rather than letting the problem fester and let students get intimidated and harassed, not being able to access facilities, have programs being disrupted, MIT not punishing students who blatantly violated university rules of access and other things because a majority of them were foreign and they didn't want to jeopardize their visas. And so we have, you know, U.S. citizens in effect having less rights than foreigners or nobody getting punished for these blatant violations and other students being harmed thereby, including Jewish students. But more broadly, I just this charge that the administration is weaponizing anti-Semitism to go after wokeness in universities is just false. Both as a matter of personnel, I know Leo Terrell and Harmeet Dhillon in the Department of Education leadership, they're sincere in their desire to eradicate anti-Semitism. I mean, yes, they see lots of other problems with universities. If you read my book, Lawless, you'll see how, it's just amazing that the heart of anti-Semitism in America lies on campus among the most educated and so-called progressive people in the country. But that's because anti-Semitism, wherever it has flared up in world history, is a leading indicator of underlying pathologies, that there's something not right about the society where it flares up. And in this context, in higher education, that means everything from cancel culture to indoctrination, intellectual corruption to moral decay. So it's not divorced from the last 10, 12, 15 years of illiberal trends, the shift away from education to activism, the shift away from classical liberal values like free speech, due process, and equality under the law, towards postmodern, critical theory of various kinds and changing structures, and all in the context of not just an anti-Semitic or anti-Israeli or anti-American, but generally anti-Western ideology that's taken root in higher ed. And so all of these things are connected, and it is certainly not going after the anti-Semitism cases just as kind of the camel's nose in the tent of taking full control of universities generally. There are a lot of things to fix, and has there been some overreach? No doubt, both procedurally and as a matter of certain substantive demands. But overall, this is trying to address huge failures of bureaucracy, ideology, and leadership in higher ed that have been allowed to fester without any oversight. You're muted, Eric.
I really have to push back a little bit. First of all, I don't know what's in Harmeet's heart. I don't know what's in Terrell's heart. What I do know is what's on paper when they sent a letter to Harvard and what's in their complaint. And those complaints were pathetic. They were truly pathetic. They were written by a child who didn't know the facts, who didn't know the law, and who said, while I'm at it, what other goodies can I steal from Harvard? What else can I force them to do? I don't know how anyone can read those in good faith and think they're anything other than disingenuous, because that's all they are. And whether it slipped past Harmeet, who I know for years and don't think badly of at all, or Leo, who I don't know at all, I can't say that. All I can say is a letter went out and they were pathetic. And then I look at the more recent complaint, which Harmeet's name is on. And I once again watch the effort to circumvent Title VI's procedural safeguards by calling it a contract violation and thus ducking all of the statutory procedures that you would need to implement Title VI. I also note that there's an interesting set of facts that stop in 2020, early 2025, just before the demand letter went out. And then I go back and read the decision in the District Court of Massachusetts that points out that the, you know, much of this has changed. Harvard's taking all kinds of behavioral changes, making all kinds of efforts to fix these problems. Yes, they were terrible. Yes, it was too late. Yes, I would smack them over the head with criticism. I wouldn't necessarily send my kid there. I would do all sorts of things. But Title VI requires more than that. And miraculously, even this recent complaint is grotesquely silent on these things. And to be silent on those things in the face of an opinion that smacked you around left and right for having done such a bad job the first time, I don't think we can say that's genuine. I think you have to recognize that litigation is being used as a weapon, not as a legitimate attempt to enforce the law. So I'm not anywhere near as positive that the current efforts are genuine, even though I know lots of people in the administration who are deeply offended by anti-Semitism, though apparently not offended enough to complain about Heritage or Tucker or Nick Fuentes. Some of them are. I'm not saying all of them, but some of them. But we should remember, anti-Semitism is not a left-wing thing. It's a radical thing on the left and the right. I oppose both versions of that. But pretending that it's just Harvard while ignoring other situations where it happens, I think reflects the fact that this is about something else. And look, I do agree with Ilya that universities have had their heads up their rear end for decades now about how they deal with what they think of as academic freedom and pluralism. Would I like to see them be more pluralistic? Absolutely. Would I like to see greater diversity on campus? Absolutely. Would I like some rule that says you have to have pure viewpoint diversity? Really? Do I need to have faculty that represent Nick Fuentes' wing of the right-wing party? Do I need to have people who represent the pro-Hamas? I think universities get to make that choice and shouldn't be forced into those broad boxes, even though it would be wise for a modest pluralism in a university if I was going to send my own kid there or want to teach there or want to speak there. So that's sort of my perspective on it, is that there's lots to be said. David talk a little bit, but I think there are interesting things that can be done in the context of Title VI. And I am not absolutist on the First Amendment on private campuses, because I think there are things that the federal government indeed could do. They're just not doing them in the right way or at all. But there are some better solutions, I think, to anti-Semitism.
I would just add that I think maybe Ilya doesn't see the problem because you engage in the same kind of failure to distinguish between what is a violation of the civil rights law that the federal government actually has an interest in enforcing and what it has no interest in enforcing. So, you know, you said, well, you know, they these schools, they let encampments exist and they let them get in the way of people's access to classes, et cetera. And they didn't punish people to the hilt and they didn't punish foreign nationals. You know, the federal government has no interest in, you know, how Columbia or Harvard or any school or Notre Dame responds to a particular protest or demonstration or encampment or violation of its own rules. That's the school's choice. And it can decide to be harsh, as Columbia was, and call in the New York police, or it can decide to engage in negotiations, as the Northwestern president did, to try to end an encampment there, or it can tolerate them for a period of time and then try to close them down, as the University of Chicago did. That is none of the federal government's business. There's no obligation on universities to enforce their rules to the max, to the hilt, in every instance. And no university does, just like no government does. The only time Title VI is implicated is if the school shows deliberate indifference to racism or sexism, not even sexism under Title VI. That's what it shows. And an encampment and sort of negotiating with people about closing an encampment or letting an encampment continue is not anti-Semitism, even if it's an anti-Israel protest in a war in which Israel's on one side and the people of Gaza are on the other side. Protesting that war is not anti-Semitism. Having an encampment that violates the school's rules is not anti-Semitism, and the government has no interest in forcing schools to enforce their own internal rules in ways the government wants them to be enforced, unless they actually have evidence of anti-Semitism. And, you know, do I deny there have been any incidents of anti-Semitism in the course of a very heated protest about a war between a Jewish state and a Muslim terrorist organization? No. I think there's been anti-Semitism and there's been anti-Islam, you know, Islamophobia and on both sides. And it's lamentable, but also understandable. And when people are feeling very, passionate about a war, they use, you know, shorthand, et cetera. But that is not what the Trump administration is doing. It is not going in and sort of saying, OK, here's the incident. That was not just a violation of, you know, neutral school rules, but actually was targeted at Jewish students. They have not made that case in any instance whatsoever. Putting aside all the procedural violations, they have not shown any interest in making that case. And that, to me, supports the notion that this is not about anti-Semitism. This is about whacking a major part of civil society that plays a major role in any democracy in, you know, checks and balances. And they're not interested in checks and balances. They're treating the media the same way. They're treating law firms the same way. They are seeking to neutralize opposition. And we should all be concerned in a democracy when the government, you know, the leaders of our government start targeting the institutions of freedom because they don't want to be checked. Even if we agree with the president, you know, in many of the things he's trying to do, I think we all have an interest in protecting the institutions of civil society. One of those is the academy. One of those is the press. One of those is the legal profession. And they've gone after all.
Let me take a moment
I think it's a little Orwellian to call higher education an institution of freedom. But regardless of that, and setting aside accusations of bad lawyering, because I think that's neither here nor there in terms of, you know, what we're really discussing. But I fully agree that just having a protest is not a Title VI violation. I agree that the government doesn't have an interest in enforcing a school's internal rules unless something rises to the level of a Title VI or other federal violation. Absolutely. But, you know, UCLA is under a consent decree. I was going to appeal that until it was shamed into dropping its appeal for doing all sorts of things to deny access and prevent the intimidation of Jewish students and whatever else. Berkeley just signed a consent decree, not with the government, with the Brandeis Center, over all sorts of, you know, anti-Zionist, anti-Semitic policies that were adopted, other things. There's a payment of damages and things. So there are very real violations that have gone on, intrusion with student programs, denial of access to, denial equal opportunity to educational programs in the language of Title VI based on protected categories. Whether the administration has sufficiently documented those, frankly, I haven't fisked all of the documents, but certainly once the investigations were concluded, not back in April of last year with the demand letters, but once the results started coming in from the various investigations in the, I don't know, five dozen schools or something that were labeled for investigation, I think there was real evidence there. Now, whether that made it in or made it in properly into the documents that were eventually set at the feet of these leaders, maybe, maybe not. I just haven't gone into that fisking. But overall, the point of going after the weak leadership and the uneven enforcement of federally relevant rules, I think very much is that issue.
Can I just say one thing? Because I want to sort of side with Ilya a little bit on this, right? I've been like I said, I was sort of two minds on this. where I part ways with Professor Cole is I do think the federal government has an interest in how the internal rules of an institution are enforced. If they are enforced selectively and discriminatorily, I believe that's a very relevant consideration. So if encampments by the, you know, by the pro-Palestinian groups are, you know, given lenient treatment, but Turning Point USA is given harsh treatment, I think there's something to be said there that this is serious discrimination and it shows a hostility towards some groups versus others. If I let Palestinian groups come into the classroom and disrupt class, am I denying Jewish students equal access to that class? But I'll kick the Turning Point folks out. I absolutely think that's infringing upon equal access to classes if you do it selectively. And while I appreciate the notion, Professor Cole's notion of, you know, the federal government doesn't enforce all its rules evenly either, that is true. We have selective enforcement and prosecutorial discretion. I, however, have called that a First Amendment violation. I think much of that discretion is improperly given deference where it deserves none, because it's clear, and I think we see it today, I think we saw it under the Biden administration. I don't think this is unique to any given administration, though it is unique, obviously, in its recency. So there's a recency bias, obviously, for everyone who talks about stuff. So I agree with Ilya that those things matter. I also think that one can have proper time, place, manner stuff. Having protests on the quad where people literally have to walk around campus at all times of day or night is a little ridiculous if you think Jewish students need to have feel safe. And suggesting that globalized intifada is not necessarily a threat, it's like saying back to Africa with the Somalis. Yeah, it's not necessarily a threat. Maybe it's advocacy for reforming our immigration laws. But man, you're on a campus with 1,000 white folks chanting back to Africa, back to Africa. I don't think anybody thinks that's a safe learning environment for Somalis. So let's not be too cute about what's political speech and what's not in the context of a non-public forum or a limited public forum, if you want to think of universities that way. They have leeway to impose time, place, manner restrictions. If the federal government demanded that they impose time, place, manner restrictions, that would probably survive constitutional scrutiny in certain instances, according to standard First Amendment analysis.
So,
if I could, let me say two things. First, we welcome questions from the audience, and we'll turn to those in a moment. So please use the Q&A feature. And second, for Professor Cole, I have a question for you, and then I'd like to open it up to the others as well, and then we'll turn to audience questions. The question that I have is, you spoke, and I think there's some agreement on the panel about slogans, generally speaking, protests in and of themselves, of course, not being Title VI violations. As I understand it, Title VI hostile environment claims typically do encompass not as prohibited conduct, but as contextual evidence supporting students' fears, that sort of thing, evidence regarding protests and regarding all kinds of speech that may not in and of itself be a violation. I mean, I think that's been a hallmark of civil rights enforcement under Title VI and other programs for many, many years, at least dealing with hostile environment type claims. And so my question to you is that right? And is there anything different about the way that the Trump administration is treating that sort of evidence in these cases? In other words, what is the law? And is that really what, and is that what the Trump administration is doing here?
Yeah. So, I'll answer that. But let me just first engage with the conversation that Eric and Ilya engaged with. You know, I do not think the government has any interest in enforcing reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions that private universities have the freedom to impose, that public universities have the freedom to impose. But the federal government has there's no First Amendment, you know, free speech act that sort of makes the government the overseer of institutions with respect to their reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. They can have them. They should have them, I think. Most of them do. Are they always applied, you know, fairly and consistently? No. Is that an issue? Most of the time, no. So, you know, you gave the example, Eric, of, you know, if they turned, if they enforced a rule against Turning Point, but they allowed, pro-Palestinians to violate the same rule. You know, that's wrong. I would be against that, but it doesn't violate any law. Doesn't violate any federal law. It's not anti-Semitic. It's not treating, if you allowed pro-Palestinian students to do one thing and denied pro-Israeli students to do the other, then that comes closer. That comes closer because it might be based on Jewish identity or might be based on disagreements about the two states that are involved. But if you could distinguish those, that would be a problem. But it's just not the case that the federal government has any interest in enforcing reasonable time, place and manner restrictions or the failure to enforce those in a fulsome way, even if you think as a policy matter, they should be. With respect to hostile learning environment claims, you know, this is one of the real difficult areas of Title VI. It's one that conservatives have most complained about. And I think for good reason, because hostile learning environment, hostile work environment is so open-ended. Eugene Volokh has been a major critic of this doctrine because it's vague and how do you draw the line between offensive speech or anti-woke speech, which we should protect, like Ilya's speech, which I defended when Georgetown, was considering whether to withdraw its offer. It didn't. But I defended it very strongly, very publicly, because I thought, although what Ilya said was racist and sexist, it was not discriminatory and it was, on his own time and it was within the area of his expertise. And he has the right to be racist, sexist. It wasn't directed at any particular person. It didn't create a hostile learning environment. So, if Ilya can do that, right, if he can make that kind of statement, which the vast majority of the community of students here at Georgetown felt was deeply racist and deeply sexist, if he has the right to do that, then I think someone has the right to put up a sign that says globalize the intifada, which I think for many people just means I support a world movement to support Palestinians. And intifada is fighting for Palestinian self-determination. Now, other people could read that in a different way, absolutely, but plenty of people read it that way. And it's certainly not anti-Semitism or anti-Semitic discrimination to say that. So if I'm a student on the,
David, I think it's irresponsible for a professor at Georgetown who's a high official at the ACLU to say that globalized intifada at a time when we have increased Islamist attacks all over the world is patty cake and just, I'm pro-Palestinian. And no matter how you try to sugarcoat this, it's not about condemning speech. And you're absolutely right that the rules about hostile educational environment are difficult, just like the rules on the jurisprudence about harassment and intimidation are very fact specific under the Davis standard and whatever else. But you cannot say that this is just, speech expression of strongly held political views.
Well, I think it is. And we have a disagreement about that. But I think what is clear under the Constitution is that if I go out on the street corner and put up a sign saying globalize the intifada and the government tried to do anything against me for doing that, I would have a First Amendment claim. And if I'm a student on the campus at, Berkeley, on the free speech part of the campus where people are, speak freely and there's no there's no sort of interference with educational, pedagogy in the classroom. And I put that up and the school punishes me for that. I have a First Amendment claim against the university because it's a state actor and it can't violate the First Amendment either. I agree. If 1,000 people are doing this, in a long term way, that's going to create a hostile learning environment. And at some point that triggers the obligation of the state to respond. But it's unclear exactly what the obligation of the state is to respond. I don't think the obligation of the state to respond is to punish the students for saying something that each one of them has an individual right to say on his own. I think the response has to be more nuanced. It has to be about ensuring, you know, students that we support you, that, you know, making sure that there's no interference with access, et cetera, et cetera. But this is a very, very difficult area, and it's an area that's been relatively rarely litigated because drawing the line between protected offensive speech and granting globalizing intifada offensive, okay? Granting it's offensive, just as I'm granting what you said was offensive.
If you're illiterate and willfully disingenuous, then yes, what I said is tremendously offensive.
No, I mean, look, I don't think that the, I've taught at Georgetown for, 30 years.
No, but that's not the point. I don't want to litigate my thing. It's all written.
Students here are illiterate or disingenuous. I think they honestly felt that what you said was deeply offensive on sex.
Yes, the standard argument against affirmative action. Anyway, we're getting far afield.
We're not getting far.
What you're saying is exactly right. You're saying that the government should not go after the students.
Because what's
and you're right. The government shouldn't go after the students. The government should go after the universities for not maintaining that learning environment where everyone can participate and have access to these programs. That's where the government should be stepping in.
Might I just chime in? It's funny. I'm the First Amendment guy, the crazed First Amendment guy here. But I actually think that sometimes speech in the wrong place, in the wrong time, in the wrong manner, even if otherwise fully protected in the public square, can indeed be a denial of access, equal access to things. If somebody stands up and screams at the Christian students saying, baby killers, you kill mothers, you kill mothers, you lying bastards, or vice versa at the women's group, at the women's hall, baby killers, baby killers. And you do that in front of the hall and you make them pass through the gauntlet. It's like the FACE Act, whether you apply it to churches, whether you apply it to abortion clinics, that harms access. And I don't think universities are the public square. They're not public parks. They're limited forums with a very specific purpose. And yes, they have the right to adopt or not adopt time, place, manner restrictions. But if they don't adopt them, and that leads to a hostile environment, that is a relevant consideration. And if they adopt them but selectively enforce them, and that leads to a hostile environment, such that Jews can't go to class for fear of being assaulted. They can't get sleep. They can't go to the library because there's someone with a bullhorn there. I'm sorry. That is not free speech, even in my book.
I 100% agree. I 100% agree. If it's a hostile learning environment, my point was that not every statement is a hostile learning environment, and that drawing the line between an offensive statement that is offensive on sexist or racist or religious grounds and a hostile learning environment.
That's not at all.
Yeah, but that's a bit of a straw man. I don't think the administration is saying these.
I'm just saying they did it at Dartmouth, and I thought they should kick the students out of Dartmouth who took over Baker Library back when I was a student. And if they're taking over the library here, they're interfering with people's education. And if they're screaming Israelis kill babies and Jews suck, I think we got a decent.
So you've just added a lot of facts, Eric, that have not been established.
If they say globalize the Intifada, I think we have a decent argument. If they took the library over.
If they show up with painted red. I mean, all of these things have happened.
So if they take over the library and say, stop the Iran war. Is there any federal law that requires the school? I think the school should not let them take over the library. But if they take over the library and say, stop the Iran war, and it precludes access by Jewish students and many other students of every other kind to use the library.
Do I think that is interfering with education? Yes. It's doing so on the basis of race? Probably not.
Right. And so there's nothing the federal government has to say about it. You know, your alumni can say something, student can say something, but the federal government has no interest in that.
Ilya and I disagree with you on whether saying Israel sucks and shouldn't exist is or isn't anti-Jewish or anti-ethnicity or anti-country of origin or whatever else is covered by Title VI.
In theory, anti-Zionism doesn't have to be anti-Semitic. In practice, 100% of the time it is.
Well, I know plenty of of Jewish, very thoughtful Jewish people who are anti-Zionist and don't
supposed
to be anti-Semitic. And I don't think they're, you know, victims of false consciousness. I think they draw a distinction. And I didn't say Israel sucks. I said globalize the Intifada. And I think there's a distinction between
the, which is worse than saying Israel sucks.
It depends on what you mean. If you mean it to say
that, no, it doesn't.
The world on what should you mean. Support Palestinian self-determination, then I don't think it's worse.
If I say we should sterilize all black people because it would improve the global economy, I don't know what I'm thinking.
You're giving a particular reading to globalize Intifada. It doesn't say kill Jewish people. It says support.
It says kill everybody who's not part of the Islamist movement.
It's worth defending this, but I think the very fact that you guys immediately go from a general statement of universal support for struggle for Palestinian self-determination to kill all Jewish people suggests that there is a problem with
just that we read history and see how this works.
Well, I just know what the problem was. I'm not suggesting that river to the sea is necessarily kill all the Jews. It's supposed to kick them out and let us take over. Globalize the Intifada, I think, takes that one extra step where we understood what the Intifada was. It's not like we're forgetting what the Intifada was. And to pretend that it means something other than that is like saying, well, the final solution. I didn't mean Hitler's final solution. I meant a different final solution.
Yeah. Why don't we move on to final statements since we're nearly at the end of the hour? Why don't we start with Ilya?
Just a minute. Look, I'm not a member of the administration. I'm not obligated in any way to, you know, defend everything that they're doing. I think there have been some missteps, more on the tactical front than in terms of the overall strategy. But they have a limited time to try to hold the university officials' feet to the fire. This illiberal takeover that we've seen in the last decade or so, as distinct from the long-term faculty bias, and indeed, you know, there is an aspect of it in that the younger faculty are more activist than like the older boomer, you know, ACLU liberal types. But nevertheless, despite certain missteps or oversteps or what have you, the administration is rightly going after the anti-Semitism that has flared up because of so much pathology in university systems and cultures underneath. Whether they could be lawyering in a slightly different way, whether they should be doing other things, I don't know. They're throwing a lot on the table. And, 4 years is not going to be enough. It's not like whether the DEI administrators or the illiberal professors or anybody else is going to go away and whatever the equivalent now of learn to code is, now that we don't need coders anymore in the AI world. So given the federal dollars at play, and we're not in a first order world where it's pure freedom of association, given strings attached to federal dollars, the government has a lot of authority to protect civil rights. And that is largely what it's doing with respect to anti-Semitism.
Thank you, Ilya. Eric?
I agree that many efforts to combat anti-Semitism are worthwhile and should be pursued. I just don't think that describes what's happening. I don't think we should be able to use federal dollars as leverage quite in the same way that they are being used. I think there are better ways to ask for time, place, manner restrictions that guarantee equal access. I agree with David Cole that hostile environment in the abstract is a little too squishy. I would be more precise about it given my First Amendment sensibilities. I think of myself as a 60s ACLU child, so I'm totally there with Professor Cole on those kinds of things. But I would very much like to see them enforced even-handedly. And it seems like we immediately flip-flop on who am I protecting today and who am I ignoring with every change in administration. And that strikes me as a recipe for disaster and for free speech problems. I would limit the government's ability to use these strings, and particularly to use these strings in sort of a shoot first, figure out what your theory is later kind of way, where if we yank $9 billion, Harvard will either die or have to settle. before any of this ever gets litigated. That strikes me as the sort of government bigfooting that is exactly the problem. It happened with the law firms. It happened with some universities. And I think to give them that kind of club to hit you with first and pretend that it'll all be sorted out in the wash 5 years or 4 years or 3 years later, that's not a recipe for respecting the First Amendment. It's a recipe for abusing it.
Thank you, Eric. Professor Cole, final word.
Yeah, so I think whether universities are illiberal or not, as Ilya has charged here, it is not an excuse for government to be illiberal. It is not a justification for the government to use its official coercive powers, its billions of dollars, to try to control a central institution of civil society. I think we should all be interested in preserving freedom of speech for those institutions that play a central role in preserving our democracy. And those are the institutions of civil society, nonprofit sector, like the Federalist Society and the ACLU, universities, the legal profession, the press. The administration has not gone after the nonprofit sector, although it's threatened to it. I don't think it has the same kinds of tools available to it, but it's gone after the rest in what is decidedly an illiberal campaign. And I think that should concern all of us. Just as I'm concerned by illiberal universities, even when they're advancing views that are sort of on my side of the aisle, I think conservatives should be concerned when the president of the United States is advancing, advancing views that many conservatives, or at least some conservatives, support. The way he is doing it strikes at the core of what is central to a functioning democracy, and that is our civil society. And universities are a central part of that.
Great. Well, thank you to our panelists, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this discussion. It was a very spirited debate, to say the least.
Sounds like we're in agreement to defund the universities, so there aren't these strings to pull.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Professor Cole, Mr. Jaffe, and Mr. Shapiro for speaking with us today, and to Mr. Grossman for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.